The views expressed by the host or hosts in this show do not necessarily represent those of our clients, sponsors, partners, or guests, and should not be considered investment advice in any way. Similarly, the views and opinions of our guests and clients do not necessarily reflect those of our hosts or our platform. Nothing shared on this platform or any other platform affiliated with us should be read and construed as constituting investment advice of any kind on the part of Insider Exchange, any of its hosts, guests, partners, or sponsors. Trading and investing carry varying levels of risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Please ensure that you fully understand the risks and take appropriate care to manage your risk. We strongly advise that you obtain independent financial, legal, and tax advice from regulated professionals and institutions before proceeding with investment decisions.
Secure the bag.
Sometimes you meet people and realize there's probably a reason why you stayed in touch.
Just listen.
Sometimes all the pieces just come together by themselves.
Woo! I'm Jimmy Moya.
And I'm Simon Brown.
Welcome to Insider Exchange.
Good morning. Welcome to another episode of Insider Exchange. Welcome to Market Matters, live streamed every Monday for your viewing pleasure. And of course, with the rest of the show coming up later in the week. On Market Matters today, we are going to be taking a look at the year that has been thus far. We're going to do a recap of the first 6 months of the year. It has only been 6 months, even though it's felt like a lot longer. We're going to look at that and we're going to try and make sense of what could potentially lie ahead in the next 6 months. And then in the deep dive, we're going to be taking a look at stock fells. It is Savings Month coming up in the month of July. We're going to kick things off for Savings Month with a look at stock fells and how you can best use those sorts of financial tools. And then we're going to wrap up the show with our investor insights, taking a look at some interesting developments from the team at Eskom, but we'll come back to that. They seem to be delving into the world of crypto mining. Before we get to that, we're back to our usual selves. I'm Jimmy once again, and Simon is once again Simon.
Who knew?
There we go, right? We figured we'd go for the classic look today because, well, it's one of those days. We're feeling that kind of way. And
I was going to say, it's Monday, but it's always Monday.
It's always Monday. But it is also Durban July week. Lots happening there. Morning, Jimbo. Morning to our community. Shout out to everybody that is joining our chat on YouTube and our live chat. But yes, back to the Durban July. Have you decided which car you're going to rent?
No, I have no idea how I'm going to get there. It's Durban. It's small. I mean, technically, you could walk it in, I don't know, 20 minutes maybe?
That's a serious power walk right there.
Is it? My sister's in Greyville. I mean, you might well be right. Yes. No, I have not. No one came forward and offered me a nice little thing, so I have to find my own transport.
Anyone out there still wanting to pick up Simon for the Durban July, let us know. He's more than happy.
Has to be in proper, like,
Durban July fashion, right?
Yeah. Right. No, like, I'm coming in a mini or something like that. Like, no.
Okay.
So how long would the walk be? Let's see. Directions. Okay. Take an hour.
Unless you power walk through it.
I don't power walk anywhere.
Mid-year recap. It is only halfway through the year.
Sure.
Even though it feels like we've gone through two
Everything
financial years and it's... Oh, I'm tired.
I'm tired too, but markets are, I mean, it has been, right? And then Bessent on Friday implied that the deadline, which is next Wednesday for the 90 days extension to the thingy-majig back in April, he implied that was getting kicked down the road to September because they haven't signed any big, beautiful trade agreements and they was going to sign 90 in 90 days. And they kind of got one with the UK and kind of got one with China, but they're not big, beautiful, all signed, importantly.
Mm.
But markets are like, yeah, that's fine. I mean, S&P and NASDAQ, all-time high. On Friday, NVIDIA's are back at all-time highs, CrowdStrike, even Nike was up 15%, and our local market is 88,700, also at all-time highs. Yeah, so we are like, don't worry about it. Everything seems to be fine. The Rand is strong, gold is 3,300, PGMs are running.
I've got a perfect summary for this, and this is a conversation I had with the team at Sanlam Investments.
Mm.
That summarizes the first 6 months.
Mm.
And it is a taco tray. Mm. Not the food taco, but
no.
Taco is actually an acronym, an abbreviation, an acronym-ish of sorts. And it's Trump always chickens out.
Yeah.
It's a proper investment term. You can Google it. Investopedia has it in everything. And I was just like, this is probably the best summary of so what we had.
There's two things to Trump. One is he always chickens out. And he's done it with all the trade things and everything. And you know, he bombs Iran and then it's like, I'm done. Cool. It's like, but absolutely. And on all the tariff stuff, absolutely. Chickened out left, right and center. What he also always does, he always says in 2 weeks. Remember his big infrastructure bill, his
all of his big beautiful bills.
It's always in 2 weeks, in 2 weeks. So the short answer is expect lots of fiery words, but nothing else coming out of the White House.
Nothing coming out of the White House. Not even...
Well, I mean, look, we have to also remember that we are currently sitting on 10% tariffs for everybody across the board, which is, you know, pretty much taking the average tariff rate back to Smoot-Hawley in the 1930s. So it's not that the tariffs aren't insignificant. They netted, I forget which month, was it May, some 20 to 30 billion in income for the US Treasury, which of course means that American citizens paid 20 to 30 billion more for their whatever it was that was coming through. But yeah, I mean, it's just a non-starter.
So
it is a taco trade.
It is a taco trade. So the markets have been filled with those for the whole year. And as you've just given a great summary, Si, everything's back to as if nothing had happened, right? As though, as you said, you and I spoke about this and you had said, if you had gone to bed in January, gone into a coma and somehow woken up today, it would have been as though you've missed absolutely nothing because markets are still at the levels that we expected them to be for the year. And it looks as though all of the volatility has been wiped out. What does that then mean for the second half of the year? Does it mean markets, number one, are more understanding of how Trump could be unfolding from a presidency perspective? Or are markets just saying, we're going to choose to ignore certain things until we have concrete facts? Because speculating now seems to be driving us mad and not really the person causing the speculation.
Yes, I mean, 100%. There is, however, a problem, which is I'll take you back to October, sort of November, maybe even January of this year, which was valuations. Not local, but US market valuations. Your NASDAQ was at like the top 5% quartile. I mean, it was absolutely insane. Even the S&P was just out of bounds. And if you remove the Mag 7 from the S&P, and Mag 493 were not cheap either. So we're back to the concern around valuations in a environment in the US where inflation is going to be higher, the dollar is going to be weaker, although they don't all necessarily mind the weaker dollar, because the other big story is the dollar's down 12 or 13% year to date. And of course, lower GDP. Now, Trump's got a plan for all of this. This is all part of his big master plan. But I don't think we can, I mean, tariffs are on pause. That's fine. Trump's probably not going to do anything to hurt the market from here on out, but it's still there and we've still got the challenge of valuations.
I think he's going to try and hurt the market, but I don't think that he can do anything that the market isn't fully prepared for, given what has happened. So I think he's probably done the worst to the market. But that being said, I don't want to push the man.
No, we should not be trying.
You don't want to push the guy with the nuclear codes.
Yeah. No, 100%. Absolutely. But it is, you know, and I mean, it does mean, I mean, basically, it goes back to your point. If we had taken a nap for the last 6 months, we would have been like, huh, so Trump's all like just like napping in the White House. We were down close to, what, 20% in April. The 10-year at the US was over 30. Our rand at one point was 19.90 to the dollar. Now we are 17.70 and change. It kind of looks like it's just been an absolute doodle. It hasn't. I suppose the question is, do we get more, and by we, I mean markets, do we get more sort of comfortable with Trump and his crazy pronouncements? And if the answer to that is yes, and surely we do. I mean, surely we understand the taco trade. Surely we understand there's a lot of bluster and craziness, but that broadly...
How many days are we left with?
Oh, I stopped counting. I'll get that to you.
So why you look for the days? I mean, I agree that in part the impact that Trump is going to have on the markets might be lessened in terms of just the extreme volatility that we've been seeing. And that's just purely because markets have learned to adjust to the volatility. Not to say that they've chosen that the volatility is not there. Markets have learned to interpret it better. better than what we've, which is good because it tells us then that after one full presidential term and possibly what, 200 days into the second presidential term, we kind of have an idea of kind of president we're dealing with. And he does unfortunately remain the focal point because of the size of the US economy. Mm. But as you said, things like valuations start to become very topical to discuss now because markets like China that have historically been undervalued and have been deeply discounted start to come back into favor and start to look very attractive again.
Yeah, 1,300 exactly.
So, days so, left.
Yeah.
That's a lot of days.
We haven't even done 200
That's yet, a lot of days.
It's a lot of days. I mean, to your point around valuations, I mean, Germany, I mean, Europe has been the perennial, lots of promise but no delivery. And that's been Europe now for,
several decades.
But, I mean, they just off highs. Germany's just off highs. France has pulled back a bit. FTSE's doing nicely. Nikkei's back above 40,000 and looking good. ASX just off highs. Nifty 50 India looking good, just off highs. So everyone's up there. It's just the difference is when the S&P and NASDAQ are at all-time highs, you're like, ooh, those valuations. When Europe's at all-time highs, it's like, ooh, those valuations.
Okay, so now, when we look at that picture, every market or most markets are just off all-time highs, and we kind of sit there with the question of, go back to the 2008 financial crisis kind of vibes.
Mm-hmm.
Things were at all-time highs before the market crash. Are we still having conversations about a market crash? Is that still something that's on the cards? Are markets just sitting there saying, we actually want to push higher now because there's no need for a crash? Valuations are resetting. Where do we stand on the recessionary talk?
So recession seems off the table for now, but certainly lower GDP is baked in. And I mean, every forecast, IMF, World Bank, everyone is saying, look, it's going to be lower GDP. We just need to get used to that for now. Recession seems off the table for now. It absolutely does. I mean, and when the liberation tariffs and stuff were coming out, recession was very much on the table. But a 10% tariff is manageable. Mm. You know, the producer will swallow some of it. The retailer will swallow some of it. The importer will, mm-hmm. you know, and then the consumer, 2.5% each, say it is a manageable a process.
Mm.
I mean, are we staring at recession? Probably not. Are we staring at market crashes? No, because market crashes don't happen from highs, they happen from lows. Market crashes are capitulations. And even if you look at the crash of 87, there'd been strong selling. If you look at the 2008, 2009, markets had been selling. Then we had that week in October where the bottom just fell out.
Mm.
Crashes happen from capitulation. So they happen from lows, not highs, typically oversold positions. That said, do we go into a bear market? And at this point, I don't see what takes global markets into the bear.
Okay.
I mean,
No,
apparently not, right? I mean, I hear you. No, I mean, wars in Europe and two wars in the Middle East and etc. And gold at 3,300 and all of this sort of stuff, you would think to yourself, yo, but apparently, nah.
It feels like we're in uncharted territory. This feels like something that we haven't experienced before.
And that's a great, actually, observation, because in a sense, we are, I mean, totally, this is Trump 2.0, but like it's different from 1.0. We are in uncharted territory. The fact that our current investment strategies at the president of the United States always chickens out is uncharted and frankly spooky.
And the spookiness is what worries me, Si. The spookiness is worries me because when does the other shoe drop? How long do we ride the wave for? These are the questions that start to come up going into the second half of the year, saying, okay, fine, let's say we have momentum to finish out the year strong. If we're near all-time highs or at all-time highs, it's safe to say then that at the end of the year we will have new all-time highs, whatever those highs might be, right? But then, what keeps driving the momentum? Because if the world is slowing down from an economic standpoint, GDPs are slowing down, the wars aren't easing up, what then drives us to continue doing well? That then points us back to those unsustainable valuations that we're already questioning in the US.
Yeah.
Does that then not happen in the rest of the world and then we have a bigger problem on our hands?
Well, I mean, the rest of the world's a long way from US valuations. Mm, in some cases, Europe could double and it would not be at US valuations.
Yeah.
You know what I think triggers it?
Mm.
How about NVIDIA misses?
Okay.
Earning miss from NVIDIA.
Okay.
Big earning miss from NVIDIA. No one's buying AI chips. AI is not going to be the... Everything just starts to... Because it's not then just your Amazon and
the FANG stocks and all of those.
That suddenly get tanked out. It's also Walmart who's spending on it and stuff. And suddenly, if NVIDIA has a big miss because of AI chips, then it's a case of like, well, hang on. You know, we're going to get all this productivity, but are we? Is it real? How does it all work? And then suddenly, do we start to see... pain and suffering.
So there was an interesting thing that I saw it online around the lithium space. Lithium deposits in the Ukraine have been seized by Russia amidst all of these war tensions and things. Now, it doesn't seem like much. I mean, the deposits still technically belong to the Ukraine. They're a sovereign state, etc., etc., etc. But when you look at lithium deposits and the role they play into industries like NVIDIA, mm-hmm. into markets like Tesla mm-hmm. and the battery conversations and the batteries that power the AI chips and all of those sorts of things, and you then say, if we're having kind of a battle for resource. Those rare earth metals out of China are one thing, but lithium is another one, right? Now, of course, we don't know the extent of what's happening. Neither of us are in the Ukraine on the ground, whether or not, you know, they're going to get this back or not. But this was a facility that, if I'm not mistaken, was owned by BlackRock, which already tells you enough information about
weird,
that.
But okay, carry on.
And apparently there were ex-US mercenaries hired to protect the facility. So whether or not they take the facility back or not, or how much truth there is to this whole conversation. That then also becomes an interesting conversation to look at, because that then means control for resource doesn't just extend to things like wars, but to what then drives the economies, what then drives the movements forward. Because NVIDIA can keep producing the chips, like you say, but if no one's buying them, then what are you going to do with them?
Yeah. And interestingly, I mean, the whole resources thing is, again, part of Donald Trump's plan. I mean, it's why I think South Africa, notwithstanding, he hates... He says, so what he wants farm murders to be priority crimes, and he wants no compensation, what, et cetera, et cetera. But we have minerals. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that whole peace deal he's claimed to have brokered in Central Africa is minerals. His whole thing with Ukraine was minerals.
So my thing is, we've seen this playbook. This is not uncharted territory. We've seen this happen from the United States. Every single time there is a mineral resource, whether it's oil or other minerals, that a particular country might possess more than others, 9 times out of 10, the US says, hey, you guys need to be liberated. We don't like your leadership. Perhaps let's assist you. Here's a couple of soldiers. Here's a war. And we know how that all works out, right? We
saw
Iran, Iraq, Libya. The list is, quite frankly, very long at this point. Right. So that's one conversation that doesn't need to be elaborated on or explained. And the US can come out and say, no, we've not done this. We've done this in the interests of the global communities and all of that. But you look at that, who's really benefited from it? It's not the people that have been invaded.
Correct.
Right. But we digress. This is not a political show, but we will answer one political question. Jimbo wants to know, if the next president of the United States is a Republican, do we think they will continue with Trump's policies? Now, my viewpoint on that is Trump doesn't know Trump's policies, much less the Republican Party knowing Trump's policies. So I don't think that's likely.
Yes and no. You read Project 2025. Mm-hmm. Pretty much he's largely sticking to that playbook. Mm-hmm. I didn't read all 100 pages. I read a summary. Thank you, ChatGPT. Yes. So what are Trump's policies? Weird, wild, woolly, and completely confusing. Could the next president continue that? Sure.
Would it make sense, though? So again, I think with something you and I have spoken about, I don't know if we've had this conversation on the show, is for presidencies, a lot of it is around legacy. Mm-hmm. What will you be known for when you leave, particularly the Oval Office, right? Mm-hmm. And that's one aspect of it. But what's very clear with the Trump conversation, and that's been the theme for the last 6 months as well, is I'm setting up my life for post-presidency, right? Mm-hmm. I'm setting up Trump Tower in Dubai as an investment conversation that I'm having with international investors or with trade talks or bilateral relations with countries, but somehow the Middle East is giving me Trump Towers when I leave office, and we're building those sorts of things. This is one person using their political office and their power as the president to set up their personal life. Now, yeah, when other people do it, we frown upon it and we talk about it and we call it names.
We call the banana republics.
Right, we call it other names. When someone else does it from the comfort of his orange tan, then we're okay with it. You You know what I mean? But whether or not someone continues with the policies, I suppose then depends on the candidate follows.
Depends on the candidate. But I think you're right. But I mean, a lot has been broken. That's going to be a long way to get back to trust. And I think even if we got a Democratic president in next time, they would have moved more to the right. And at some point, we will get more Republican presidents, and we just don't know what they will do. I mean, there was a sense of, I've said it before, where it turns out that democracy was a lot more about norms than actual regulations. And that has been completely shattered, and it's left the whole rest of the world like a little bit stunned. And so it gives us less odds to know what will happen. And, you know, the Paris Accord, Obamacare, those sort of things went in, and, you know, Republicans didn't like it, but there was a sense that they would be there and the new Republican administration might tinker with it, but now they just throw it out. So now every 4 years, new president, you're in, you're out, you're there, you're other way, and everyone else is just like, yo, you guys, do you go play in the small room, work it out, we all let that out.
To be fair, this is the same Republican Party that was brave enough to say, yes, we want another 1,500 odd days of Donald Trump after the first 1,000 plus days that we had. So the fact that he's being re-elected in the first place is already something that makes us question what Republicans were thinking around that.
Well, there's a quick theory out there, and again, let's stay away from politics, but MAGA, instead of MAGA, it should be Make America White Again. That's his base.
Make America MAWA.
MAWA.
That's where we're going to leave it. That's the Market Matters for this week. MAWA, according to Simon, Make America White Again. But yes, stick around. The deep dive and investor insights will be dropping later in the week. Thanks for tuning in to Market Matters. We're going to leave it on that note. Jimbo, we are so happy that you resigned of your own free will and you are happy with that resignation. He said it was time to go.
Okay.
We wish some other people in the world would take that advice, but we're going to leave that conversation on that note. That's Market Matters. In our deep dive this week, we are diving into the world of Stockfels. We're going to be taking a look at this in light of the month of July that kicks off Savings Month in South Africa. And Si and I had quite an interesting conversation around that, and we thought perhaps we'll do maybe one or more conversations around savings and wise decisions where we can find them. But more than that, Si, you and I spoke, and you said Savings Month has been going on since 2010.
01.
2001, and South Africans haven't been saving. And I came back with a response to say it's because South Africans don't have money to save.
Which is a fair point. I mean, there's the FNB retirement thingy-majiggy, which came out Thursday or whatever last week.
And if you
look at that data, middle-income earners in South Africa are reducing the amount that they're setting aside for retirement. Now, that's not because they all expect to win the lotto, although they would certainly hope to. It's because they don't have money. And we keep on talking around, you know, are we as individuals, mostly as a collective, rather better off than a year ago? Sure, yes. Inflation's down, rates are down, two-pot money, et cetera, et cetera. But let's be clear, it's relative. It's not like we're out in the streets parting.
Somebody was
the other day and woke me up. But I mean, we're not, you know, it is still massively tough.
But you bring up the two-pot thing, and I think I see that as a perfect example of how South Africans don't have money. Mm-hmm. The amount of two-pot withdrawals that we're seeing, and it's people saying, yes, it is only 30,000 Rand. Yes, it is still going to be taxed, but it is more money than I have right now, and I can put that money to something. The two-pot withdrawals should not be this high. We should not be happy that people are accessing their retirement funds early, because it means then that the current situation is not tenable. People are unable to get through things as they stand, and therefore they're saying, I will have to dip into this two-pot thing because I need to plug some of the holes. And for me, that is a more alarming thing than saying, hey, two-pot, you now have access to your two-pot money, blah, blah, blah. It's worrying that so much of the two-pot money is being withdrawn.
Yeah. And evidence is it's going to debt. I mean, that doesn't like overwhelmingly reassure me. It just says people have got so much debt that they're prepared to sacrifice some retirement to get rid of the debt. And then the question is that what got you into debt in the first place, paying off the debt doesn't stop you from getting back into debt time around. And then coming back for more two-pot. And so
it's a vicious cycle that could potentially start.
Yeah.
So perhaps we look at and this is why we looked at the Stockfels conversation, was to say perhaps there is another way. And I remember penning an article about Stockfels quite some time ago. And one of the things that I highlighted in that article, and we spoke about it when we spoke about property investing with Moshima on this show a couple of episodes ago as well. I said, it's probably the most powerful tool out there that we have as a population.
Yeah.
Because it allows you to achieve fractionalized investment into something without the risk of leverage that would come with derivatives trading and that sort of thing. But at the same time, it allows you to reduce your risk and still access a return of sorts. Now, understanding, of course, that because it's fractional investing, your return is also going to be fractionalized
sure.
in its return. But it does mean then that you have so much. I wish people just understood how much power you have as a collective.
Yeah. And I think there's lots to it. You know, I mean, pre-easy equities, if you rocked up with anything under 20,000 for a single transaction, you were going to be paying huge amounts.
Mm.
The easy equities now means you can literally do $100 back to your fractionalized part. But it's more than just the money. It's pooling knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, particularly when you're new into it, it's like, this is a little bit scary. Because to be clear, stock fall could be a grocery stock fall, a saving, a birthday, a property, an investment club. I mean, they all fall broadly under that process. And you know, when you're starting out, the whole thing's just a little bit scary.
Mm.
Well, it's a little less scary if there are four or five of you sitting around the table.
Let's put it into context, right? The one thing I love about what our community has become over the last year, right? And we're going to celebrate our 1 year anniversary in the month of July as well, is the size of the community and how people just engage with one another. And I'll use our community as an example because it is exactly that, a growing community that can be a great example for Stockfells. If we said to our community today, and we've thrown this out as a joke and all of those sorts of things, but if we said to our community today right now, hey guys, we're starting a community Stockfell at Insider. We're going to have every community member put in R1,000, right? Let's just take not all of our community across all of our platforms. Let's just take our TikTok community at the moment that has 25,000 plus people from that perspective. If every person there put down just R1,000, right? And it's not even R1,000 on a monthly basis. It is a once-off R1,000, right? So let's say we do it once in January and then we take that money and it goes into investing into properties or other things. That's 25 million rand of buying power you have from a one-off deposit. Yeah. Now, if you start to do this...
You could buy De Beers.
We could get to De Beers, right? Now, if you start to do this on a monthly basis, let's say, for example, fine, take half of that. Let's say the 350 Rand social grant or whatever, one of the months you sacrifice, and let's say everybody puts in 500 Rand, mm-hmm. right? 500 Rand per month over, call it 6 months, mm-hmm. right? 500 Rand over a month over 6 months is 1,000 Rand over 3 months, is 75 million Rand across 25,000 people. Do you know what you can do with 75 million Rand as a pooled stock firm? And I've always looked at that and said, but guys, this is probably the best tool that we can use because all it requires is, and for some reason, this is the most difficult part of a Stockfell, is an aligned vision.
So, I mean, let's assume everyone's got the 1,000, but that therein, the next challenge is that aligned vision.
The administration of it and all of those things.
But you got 25 million. I mean, you really now do have the ability to properly manage this and to have the administration and to have a CEO and a CFO and to be as a PTY and issuing shares rather than the old fashioned stock fall, which was, you know, money in a pocket type of thing and et cetera. So you really do have that ability to properly do it, to pay officers, et cetera, execs, whatever you want to call them.
And you also don't have to be excessive about your expenditure, right? So you don't have to have a flashy office, a flashy CEO, salaries and all of that sort of thing. No, if everybody has an aligned vision that says that all we want to do from this 25 million Rand, so take the 25 million as a good example, right? We take the 25 million, we go and we don't even have to put it into the stock market. We go in and we buy a commercial property.
Mm.
You buy one commercial property at 10 million, you buy another one at 10 million, you've got 5 million of operating expenses or whatever to run both and all of that. That property has tenants. It'll earn you an income. It is an asset that you can leverage into the banking system to get more capital, to buy more assets, which is effectively what people then do when looking to build on.
Yeah. I mean, if you come in at an LTV, loan to value of say, I don't know, 25%, your 100 million is, sorry, your 25 million you're talking about can also get scaled. But your earlier point was, we don't don't need debt in this situation.
I mean, you don't.
I see the attraction of it.
Suddenly you can have an investment, exactly as you're saying, we don't need debt. And I think that's a critical thing to try and understand. Yes, there is value in debt. Yes, there is value in using the capital and paying a nominal interest rate on that borrowed capital, provided you're earning more than that. Separate conversation for a separate day. But you can effectively run a full-on stockfell setup where you don't need any debt.
Yeah, yeah. And there are, so it's many things. It's the pooling of resources, and that does bring power with it. I know that easy equities will give you fractionals, but that really does create power, is that ability to pool resources. Pooling of knowledge, hugely powerful as well. Pooling of the admin part. No one likes the admin part, but now you can, I mean, depending
now
on...
Now you do it once instead of 25,000 times.
Exactly. So it is hugely powerful. And I mean, South Africa, it's got, what's the last number? 60 billion or something crazy sitting in stockfalls. Most of it sitting in cash outside of the formal economy, which drives the FSPs the world over completely crazy. Not the world over, South Africa over. But that's their problem, not ours.
Mm-hmm.
We're thinking here is kind of taking stockfalls away from our grandparents who've been using them for forever and a day, and saying we can do them like differently.
Because
back in the day, I mean, my sister had a stockfall 30 years ago, but it was just cash, right? So everyone would throw in money, and once a month, one of you got all the money, so that you basically got a bonus, extra bonus.
But this is something you can still do, right? So I think, again, coming down to the alignment and the aligned vision that you then have from a stockfall point of view, is if we then agree, okay, we have this amount of buying power, this is what we're going to do with it, right? We can go out and buy 25 1 million rand apartments, put all 25 of them on Airbnb, get all of that money because you've bought them cash. So all of the revenue you're generating from them is to either maintain the property or to get you a return. Mm-hmm. And you then go from 25 to owning 50, to owning 100, to owning 200, to building an entire property portfolio. And then at the end of it, if your stockfall runs over 10 years and never receives another day of investment other than the initial investment, after 10 years, you probably would have enough property to then give everyone back as an investor an apartment that's fully paid off.
Wow. Yeah.
It's not like
you get Baldwin to build a an entire city for you.
That's it, right? So and that's capital at work, because at the end of the day, when it comes down to whether you're looking at investment decisions, whether you're looking at property, it doesn't really matter what asset class you're looking at. The one thing that comes into there's two things that come into play from an investment point of view. It's information about whatever it is you're investing in. That is one form of currency. And the other is capital.
Mm-hmm.
And when you've got the capital, and like you said, with the pooling of resource and the pooling of expertise, you're pooling information as well, right? So now you can make an informed decision and you have the capital to move on that decision. Why are we not doing this more?
Yeah. And you also have, I mean, it's like the buy-to-let. I always said that, I mean, I hate buy-to-let in the property space, and there's some real challenges with it. And some of those challenges are just that you need some critical mass.
Hmm.
And that critical mass, depending who you speak to, is somewhere between 30 and 50 units.
Mm-hmm.
Well, boom. Yeah, you've got, 25 million, you've got your units.
And okay, let's say there's several million people employed in the country, several million unemployed people, right? So let's say for the first 2 months, we put aside 1,000 rand each for 25,000 people that are able to do that. It's 50 million. We don't do anything with it. And at the 50 million mark, then we go out and purchase the properties. We can now suddenly buy properties in Cape Town that have historically now become ridiculously unaffordable. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And the ROI that you're starting to see, and this is just, again, property is one example of
what you can. Yeah, yeah. We just happen to be focusing on it.
That's it. It's not to say it's the only thing you can do with a stock firm.
You could buy little businesses, you could buy franchises. You know, what about
you're buying revenue, right? Yeah, you're buying cash flow.
What about taking your 25 million and buying, I don't know what they cost, 10 franchises, 10, you know, I don't know, whatever franchise.
25 million gets you 1.5 McDonald's.
Yeah.
Okay. So a McDonald's franchise is probably about 15 million or
but
so.
But you can get, we both jumped to QSR, but what about dry cleaning? What about, there's others out
That's
there.
That's it.
And to your point, what are we buying? Revenue.
Yes, you're buying revenue. You're buying buying cash flow and you're buying credibility with a bank, with an invest. You can build an entire investment vehicle that then goes out and either buys distressed assets, buys discounted assets. You start to flip those assets into more revenue and then you sell them off to someone else. Prime example of a good sale, right? And this wasn't a sale from a distressed asset. This was a business that was built, held onto at the, and then at the right time, someone came in, offered you money, and then you went, right? Last week, Bank Zero, Michael Jordan's baby that he'd been curating and growing for so many years, went and was bought out by Lesaka Technologies at R1 billion. Now, I'm not saying that every single one of the businesses you buy is going to turn into R1 billion opportunity. We've seen what happens with the likes of Naspers trying to flip a Mr. Delivery and a Take a Lot. It might take longer, right? But when you suddenly have the buying power to go and take that kind of risk and say, we're going to identify 10 or 15 businesses, and out of all of those 10 or 15 businesses, we only need one of them to hit the right volumes or the right levels. Now you've got the expertise to say, which 10 do we identify? How do we do this? How do we build it? How do we grow it? And the buying power is there. I think for the longest time, when you sit there and you don't have buying power, it limits what you start to look at in terms of opportunity. But if the buying power is not a limitation, if money is no object effectively, do you understand what you can do from a business perspective?
Exactly.
Just have an aligned vision. Just have the common vision.
So, and that's the hard part, but it's not an impossible
part. It's not impossible. It really isn't.
Yeah.
And Stockfels have such a powerful way of getting people to do that. I think in this day and age, people need to demystify exactly what you're saying about how Stockfels used to be viewed. We used to have this whole, oh, but this lady ran away with the Stockfel money, or this gentleman ran away with the money of the Stockfel, or whatever. And that has happened. The reality is that has happened. But in the day and age that we live in now, an age where digital transactions happen and currency is information and capital, and you have a setup or a tool that fundamentally people understand. Because if I have to explain to someone what a derivative instrument is versus explaining to someone what a Stockfel is, I know which of the two conversations is an easier conversation to have, right? Yeah. And it's not because one is a lesser product than another. No, by no means is it that. It is just simply because we know what Stockfels are. Yeah. So let's use them.
Yeah, so let's use them. I think that's the key point. Let's use them.
Let's use them. Folks, we'd love to get your thoughts on that. Give us your thoughts around the Stockfel communities. Would you start a Stockfel? Would you be part of a Stockfel that was started? And what would your conditions be? Because there has to be an element of trust. There has to be an element of we can believe that this is for the right intentions. So if somebody were to say, let's start a Stockfel, what sorts of measures would you want to put in place? Obviously, I mean, what jumps to mind for us is things around regulation and structure and all of those sorts of things. But that's because we come from a formalized financial services environment, right? But we'd love to hear your thoughts on that. We'd love to hear your take on the Stockfel world and what we make of it. We're going to leave the deep dive on that note. We're going to get into investor insights. We're going to be taking a look at a particular stock pick that we're adding to the wall, but we're also going to be taking a look at something very interesting from Eskom. They've decided they want to go into crypto mining. We wrap things up with Investor Insights. We're taking a look at a very brave decision by the team at Eskom to go into the world of crypto mining. And we're also going to add something interesting to our wall. Now, I saw this. The CEO of Eskom, Dan Marokane, said that crypto mining could be an alternative for Eskom from a power perspective. We've seen a huge shift in people going off-grid in terms of their housing and their electricity requirements. And it was a very interesting statement to come out that Eskom would potentially start to look at that side of the world as a new stream of income for them, because effectively crypto mining, and we know whatever type of mining you do from digital assets point of view, requires a lot of power. We've seen a lot of people go the solar farm route, of course, to say I'll power my crypto mine with a solar farm and all of those sorts of things. But do you think this is viable?
Well, I mean, is this during stage 4 load shedding or stage 2 load shedding? Because if I'm being load shed so that old Dan and his buddies can make some bitcoins, I'm like maybe not so thrilled. Let's pretend for a moment that we don't have load shedding and that things are working fine and that we're not running the open turbine gas generators and that things are fine. A lot of pretending going going on, but nonetheless,
still pretending. Answer,
why not? I mean, and the problem is that boat has sailed, but we used to have huge excess capacity on our grid. Mm-hmm. There must be points of time during the day when, you know, Eskom must be able to say, look, we've got 2 gigawatts of excess. Let's take 1 gigawatt and mine. Mm-hmm. And then as they lose gigawatts for whatever reason, demand or something like that, they can pull back on the mining. In other words, they could manage us smart.
So that's the interesting thing. They're not saying they will do it themselves. And you've just given them a brilliant idea here.
Then who's going to do it?
They're saying that for the crypto miners out there, they will provide the power, resources.
Come on, Hillside Aluminium Smelter up in Richards Bay. We gave them cheap power because we had lots, and we're still giving them cheap power and we don't have lots anymore. I want to see that contract.
Yes.
First. Oh, they want to entice crypto mining.
That's it. So they want to entice people because, exactly as you've said, demand has reduced. And I spoke to independent energy analyst Tsepo Kadima around that, and he said the demand, because of the fact that people have gone off grid onto solar, demand on the Eskom grid has reduced dramatically, and it will only continue to decrease even more. So much so that, of course, Eskom has felt that they need to put satellites in the air so that they can see who's not correctly registered for solar by checking whether or not you've got a solar panel on your rooftop. But let's not digress. Let's stick to the point. They're trying to encourage demand after 16 years of having people suffer through load shedding to the point where people have decided, I would rather go into debt to get off of Eskom's grid. Now, suddenly, they want people to be like, oh, no, we'll stay on the grid. We want to be on the grid.
Is our power cheap enough? That's the trick.
Our power was the cheapest in the world at some point.
Now it's about the middle of the thing.
No, but that's not because power generation has suddenly become that much more expensive.
No, it's because Eskom's just charging us more.
Exactly.
But for a crypto miner, the numbers need to add up for me.
That's it. And that's the other part of it, is the numbers are so critical from a crypto mining perspective, because I'm not mining one Bitcoin a day. It takes me a lot to mine a little bit in terms of the overall output, right? So much so that it's not good for retail miners. It might be good for industrial grade miners. If I'm a MicroStrategy perhaps that wants to put money into mining instead of buying the Bitcoin, but then why would I do that? Why would I go put the money into the mining of the Bitcoin when I can just buy the coins and hold the coins as I already do, right? That's another conversation, I suppose, for another time. But from a power point of view, you're saying to the market, hey guys, we are trying to attract new demand because we're seeing we're losing existing demand. Fine, very noble. But then at the same time, you're saying to the same consumers in the South African market, we're going to apply for a 30% increase to the tariffs every single year because we need to cover our costs and those sorts of things. This just, you're not running the organization efficiently.
Yeah, so I just did a quick look. You need, I mean, there's T's and C's here, but let's call it 15 cents per kilowatt hour kind of gets you to your economics of scale. And we are effectively paying
R5 something.
2.36 in Joburg per kilowatt hour.
Right. And I think there's other areas where we're paying R5 per kilowatt hour. And I remember when I spoke to Tsepo Kadima, he said we should be paying no more than R1.22 in tariff, right? Mm. So we're paying excessively more than what we should be paying right now as it is. And then you want to then say to the consumer, hey, let's make it more attractive for you to come and mine crypto here instead of just supplying electricity to the places that you want to supply electricity to.
Yeah.
And you're not collecting revenues because...
And it's also, are you trusting enough to set up your crypto mining farm in South Africa where and Eskom is effectively your partner,
only supplier?
Your partner.
Or if I go, let's say I set up a crypto farm in South Africa. Great, lovely. I have the option right now, and this is what private capital does have, is the optionality to then build it as a solar farm and do it that way. Where is the incentive for me to, because you can't suddenly say, oh, but what if the sun runs out? That's a very, very silly argument that we're not putting forward here, right? But has Eskom still got the trust? And that's the important question you raise, Sai. Has Eskom got the trust left in the market to be able to then convince
people? The answer is not within 100 miles, surely.
Maybe there's no transmission line in that 100 miles.
Entirely possible. I think Eskom should balance their load and do some. And every so often they turn on the Stikfontein hydroelectric, make four coins. Point is, four coins, $500,000. Nice. Doesn't help Eskom's problem.
Doesn't. There's several. And perhaps that's another conversation for another day, is what does help Eskom's problem? That's not for us. I mean, there's an entire team at Eskom that has that figured out. And apparently this is part of that plan. But we're just weighing in on Eskom's bid to potentially go into the provision of resource for the crypto mining space. Give us your thoughts on that. Is it viable? Does it make sense? Should they be looking at other things? We're going to move on to our stock pick. And this week's stock pick, we haven't had too many of them come up onto our wall. We're adding a company called Foresight to the wall. Why is that?
So it's a weird little business. I chatted with the CEO, Tisha Zitzko, on my show this morning around results. The results weren't bad. There was so many moving parts. There was comparisons were hot. But in essence, what they do is they come to your business and they are across all industries and they've got a partnership program which puts them a really, really strong presence into the rest of the continent, most notably East Africa, Kenya, but basically everywhere as demand comes on. And what they're doing is they're saying, okay, so you've got Microsoft Outlook and they will sell it to you, but there's not much money in that. Can we put something on top? And that something on top could be you had a meeting and it automatically a day later sends a follow-up email or something like that, a sales call. So it's sort of trying to make your stuff smarter and simpler. And I know those are two contradictories, but you can make it a lot of automated. He talks a lot around AI and agentic agents. I think a lot of it might be machine learning, which is sort of the more entry level, but that's fine. It kind of works there too. And I mean, their margins are currently 4-5%. I think that there's space here where they can get those margins up. They can get a lot more traffic through there. And in essence, if they make a piece of software which is really good in game changers, they can then sell it into their channel. So much like CrowdStrike. CrowdStrike starts off, they've got 10 little pieces of security software that they sell to people. And then every time they add another piece, they've got their expanding a bunch of people, of customers, and they can say, hey, now we've got the strawberry flavored one, and we've got the yellow one, and the pink one, and et cetera, et cetera. And they can then expand that in. So you're growing your client base, you're growing the offering to the client base, and your clients become a little bit addicted to you, because when they wake up one day and they say, we don't like Foresight anymore, we want to get Twosight, Foresight's like, well, sure, delete it all and
that's
knock
it.
Knock yourself out.
So you also build that dependency from a client perspective. Okay.
So, I mean, you know, are they there? No. Will they get there?
Maybe.
We'll find out. But it's one I'm keeping a look on. It's just, it's a very simple business model. You know, we've had box droppers before in South Africa, a Mustek is still, where they go and sell computers. I mean, those are nice, but what's your edge? Yeah, they come and say, you know what, our edge is that you've got Windows, let us make it work smart. You've got a CRM software, you've got a monitoring software, whatever it might be, depending on your industry. You know, you're a farmer, you've got a drone, but what are you doing with that data that's being collected, etc.? We produce as individuals and as corporates like more data than ever before. Can it be cleverly used? Yes. Can it be uncleverly used? Also, yes. But I really like, and there's a lot of buzzwords and they always kind of slightly bother me, but it's something we should just, this is something that if it works, this could do really, really well because of that dependency that you create, because of that sales channel where as you launch new products and drop those in. Stock's not expensive. Yeah.
So I see the appeal and the play on data, because that's what you're leveraging here is we're going into data differently, right? And because we're omni-channel, omni-industry, we can build you solutions for any and everything that you need your business to do. I suppose the bigger question then becomes, how long does it take for a Foresight to build a tailored solution, right? So I can build a general solution that is generic to a CRM, or I can build a tailored solution tailored to that particular business. Now, there's risks on both sides. There's risks that if it's too tailored, there won't be enough of a customer base. If it's too general, it's easily replicable and can be easily replaced kind of thing. So I think for me, the question then becomes is, how quick are you at deployment? How innovative is your solution and how unique is your solution in the markets that you operate in? And then I suppose the rest of it doesn't really matter beyond that, because if you're building solutions that people need. And that's why I went the tailored route, because some things that I need, another business might not.
So I hadn't thought of that. The tailoring is a competitive advantage, but also a massive risk.
And I
honestly don't know how much they do or don't tailor, but it is potentially a huge risk. If you've got to go and tailor every little thing, signing up 10,000 new accounts is not lacquer.
It's not.
But then, I mean, CrowdStrike doesn't tailor. I mean, they've got, you know, it's basically cookie cutter. And I'm not sure how much, you know. So CrowdStrike is doing it really simple. They're at the kernel level and they are doing security. So whereas Foresight's
which
doing,
is their niche.
Correct. Mm. Foresight's doing a whole lot more, which does potentially add some
But it also brings diversity, right? So you can then say, we can compete with CrowdStrike on the security, but we can also compete with a CrowdSense that does other things and all of. So it kind of builds you into a diversified business. And I for one, happen to really like diversification. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's what's too diversified? What's spreading yourself too thin? That being said, how much do we like the stock? Where does it sit on the wall?
I want to watch it.
Okay.
Yeah, this isn't something I'm rushing out to buy. Let's go and watch it. Let's see how it plays out. This is no major rush, is it? Because there are risks. They've had some missteps in the past, and I appreciate those are in the past. Let's see how they go.
Okay, so we're going to add it to the wall. It doesn't make blue chip just yet. We're going to see where we throw it onto the wall, perhaps under really like it, perhaps under some easy money. We'll see where we feel about it. And then we will update the wall from that perspective. We'd love to get your thoughts on that as well, around just where you see information heading, data, and the value of data. And I suppose what kind of companies out there make sense. If there's a company you'd like us to take a look at, please, of course, let us know. We'd gladly do that and see if we can shed some light on it. And of course, this was not financial advice. We don't do that on the show. Anyone that tells you that we do is lying to you. Don't believe everything you read except our disclaimer. That is a very valid disclaimer to believe. And we're going to leave the conversation on that note. Before we go, as always, we have an unfiltered opinion of the week for you. And this week's unfiltered opinion is largely weather-driven, but also probably a lot of sense to it, right? Si, what's the unfiltered opinion of the week?
We should be Durban during winters. Wintertime, we go to Durban. We get there 1st of June. We can come home September sometime.
Okay.
All of us, Joburg.
Everybody, go to Durban.
Cape Town's welcome. Everyone. Durban's biggish. We'll
don't
fit.
Go there in the end of the year.
We'll make a plan. We'll
go fit. There for winter.
Go there for winter.
Okay. Alongside that, another alternative if Durban gets too packed is Limpopo. Weather there is remarkably great, pleasant.
Limpopo, I love it.
No beach. No beach. We can build a beach. If we can build a beach in Pretoria, we can build a beach.
25 million.
There we go. There we go.
Beach in Pretoria, in Limpopo.
There you go. That's what we're using our Stockfell money for. That's Insider Exchange. We're going to leave it on that note. Remember, investing isn't hard. Just try it. The views expressed by the host or hosts in this show do not necessarily represent those of our clients, sponsors, partners, or guests, and should not be considered investment advice in any way. Similarly, the views and opinions of our guests and clients do not necessarily reflect those of our hosts or our platform. Nothing shared on this platform or any other platform affiliated with us should be read and construed as constituting investment advice of any kind on the part of Insider Exchange, any of its hosts, guests, partners, or sponsors. Trading and investing carry varying levels of risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Please ensure that you fully understand the risks and take appropriate care to manage your risk. We strongly advise that you obtain independent financial, legal, and tax advice from regulated professionals and institutions before proceeding with investment decisions.